professorship in Nifonso Family Law with Skills, November 4th, 2008, podcast number 3 in room number
242.
Okay. So basically, I have some more questions for you. Did you blank back letter? So you're going to do your 3 issues in the letter and say, you know,
you don't
know,
blah, blah,
blah, but I need to know if you're.
Well,
okay. So I'll give further direction.
Okay.
Also, Where is everybody? Quickly on the AFCC New York workshop on Friday that I told you about. I've gotten word that we can have people who, if you want to go for the whole day, that can now be free.
Whatever.
You have to see Jeff Dodge. Remember, I know Jeff Dodge is in Dean's office, and he will fax in a registration for you, and you can have it for free if you want to go the whole day. With lots of interesting things. On Saturday, you get to see Andy. That's the treat. In the morning, you get to see me in the afternoon. That's the treat.
Yeah, you get to see other people who know something.
And you get to see other people who know something. So it is a very useful thing. It's a good opportunity for networking, et cetera, et cetera. If you want to go for the full, you can always go for the afternoon and just show up and do that jobs panel I told you about. You just do that without registering. Just come in, and that's free. But if you want to do a whole day, including lunch, that's also free. Jeff Dodge, and he'll fax your registration number of the day, and I brought a bunch of these in case you're interested. That's the last thing I'm saying about it.
Go! That's the last thing I'm saying. Okay, now what do we need?
You want to talk about the final?
Yeah, the final. Here's the final, okay? Finally? Okay. Oh, yeah, we're polishing it. No, we're not. Sorry, that was a joke.
That's anyone's idea of a joke. I hope you all got that.
A little law professor humor. Very little. Okay, look. We got to start with the premise that you don't like taking them, and we don't like writing them, and we don't like grading them. Okay? But we got to live with this, so we're going to do this in the best way possible that we found. We're going to give you 24 hours. You can take it any time during the exam period. Got your clock out, and then you resubmit within 24 hours. Okay, it will be open book. Do you have a problem back there?
The timing mechanism is when you download the exam, you will send Betty an email saying,
"I have downloaded the exam."
The email will have a time on it,
and then 24 hours by email. You'll submit by email, which gives us a timestamp.
No,
we're not.
No.
Strike that.
You can pick it up. You can download it from Twent. You will then send Betty an email at the same time. The email will have a time on it.
Right.
That starts your clock. You will then hand deliver it to Betty.
Right.
So you have to make one trip.
Okay.
Which means you can't take it out on the last day.
Correct.
Got it? Because you won't have 24 hours. I just say that just in case somebody. All right, so
okay, so basically you can arrange your own schedule,
and you don't need 24 hours. This is crazy. It's crazy season. You need a few hours, right? So don't worry about it. But you have 24,
and you will be, and it will be open book, so you can just consult. But when we say open book, what we mean is the materials in the course. You don't do outside research,
and no human beings.
Right, you can't talk to your father or mother who's a matrimonial lawyer. That's out of the question. And you will sit. Now look, this procedure, and I'm going to raise something with you, which I did last time I did this for class. This procedure fundamentally counts on your honesty. Okay? When you submit that exam, you will be certifying that you followed the rules and you didn't consult with anybody. Okay. And you didn't consult anything other than the stuff that we did during the semester. Okay, you know, the material consulting.
Facebook stuff and Twen.
And Twen and your notes. If we find out that somebody violated that trust, we will have to deal with it extremely seriously. Don't put us there. Okay? This exam is being organized to maximize the convenience to the students, for you, basically. Okay? We could put you in a room, right? Put a proctor in front of you and do it the other way. But we think you're big boys and girls and understand what we're doing here, right? So this depends on the level of trust that you have in large part on each other. Do we have to say anything more?
We'll describe it in a little more detail toward the end, but basically that's what it is.
Okay. Any questions about that you need to know now? So you'll have from the first day of examination period to the end of the day of examination period, and you'll block out 24 hours.
Second to last.
Second to last.
It's too bad you're achieving your office.
The first day counts from the first reading day? Or
no, we're not allowed to do that. We
actually can.
So we can.
So it's starting like Friday or Thursday?
Whatever the first day
of examinations is, and to the next to last day for the weekend.
Yeah, like a weekend.
No, you have to turn it in.
Let us talk about this a little bit more, but we had the idea last time I did this,
by the way, and I had no problems and no complaints. People turned in their exams by email.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with that. Why just do it? You'll direct it.
I think the registrar has a special email address.
That's what we need to find out.
We'll find out.
If we can let you submit them by email,
we will. Okay? You'll put it in MS Word or WordPerfect and submit it, and we'll print it out for you.
All right. Any other questions? We need to get going on that. There will be a page, by the way. All right. We had some excellent questions on the surrogacy assignment.
Amy emailed some questions about the surrogacy assignment in terms of how you should submit the written memo if you want it in letter form. We want it in letter form. Basically, you're going to be writing a letter to your client, and you're going to be issue spotting. You want 3 issues outlined with headings, subheadings, and also I'm going to post fact patterns for the husband and wife. They're going to be very short, and a fact pattern for the surrogate mother. Again, very short. And in your letter where you issue spot, you're going to also have questions for your client. So you're going to pretend like your client's going to come in for a second meeting with you. And in your letter, you're going to say, okay, I've looked over the agreement. These are some of the issues that I see. Some further questions that I have for you that you need to think about when you next come in, we'll talk about are. And you're going to outline your questions, what you need to know from your client in order to really advise them on this contract. So hopefully I'll get that all posted on SWEN, I would say by the end of the day tomorrow. Is there any other questions on that assignment?
It is a gestational surrogate. It's a gestational surrogate. There's no other kind. I mean, technically, you could have a baby M surrogate, but no one in their right minds would ever do that because it's, boy, everywhere, all 50 states, and beyond.
KBM was the first great surrogacy case.
Yeah. So we'll talk about that. I'm doing that Thursday, right?
Thursday
we'll talk about that, but just so you know, the surrogacy, the only surrogacy contracts that exist, and they're illegal in some places too, so the only surrogacy contracts that are even imaginable about that lawyer's draft are contracts where the woman who is the surrogate is the gestational surrogate. That means she's giving birth to the baby, carrying to term and giving birth to, but is not genetically related to the child. Okay? And don't use biological. I've often heard students say she's not biologically related. When you're giving birth to somebody, you're biologically related to the person in your womb. So biology is actually... Don't use a word because it's confusing. Everybody's biologically related, whether you're related by a genetic link or a birth canal. It's biologically related. Biology is actually out the window. Think of it in terms of genetics.
Now, yeah.
How are you biologically related, though? If there's no genetic.
I refuse to believe that a child that comes out of your womb is not biologically related to you.
That,
yeah. Nobody uses that term anymore. genetics. Think in terms of genetics. The child is genetically related to you or is not. Now, the legal determination, legal parenthood, that's a different question. We're going to talk about that on Thursday. The states differ on what they mean by that. All I'm saying is when you read Baby M, hopefully you've read it already, you'll see that's the old-fashioned surrogate. That was that child's mother. Mary Beth Whitehead had a baby. She wasn't a surrogate. She had a baby. She promised to sell her baby to the Stearns.
I'm not.
In the 1970s, maybe that wasn't as clear as it is today. Nobody does that, at least not intentionally. If you see it done, you don't have anything to do with it as a lawyer. So the only kind of contract you'll be considering are genetic contracts, and it's a gestational surrogacy only.
So in other words, you do a Baby M contract, you're going to jail. But that's neither here nor there. We'll talk about that when we get to it. Baby M, by the way, was almost as big a soap opera as I gather some aspects of Diana's family. It had made-for-TV movies all over it. It had it was the subject of numerous television shows and talk shows.
It was
the OJ at the time, actually. It was kind of like a really fascinating.
It was Marvin.
I'm sorry, I wasn't here for this, but I got to do what I was in Los Angeles when Marvin versus Marvin was decided. Okay, and I do want to report to you, and I don't want to re-raise this issue. Two things. I saw Lee Marvin actually testify during that case. I went outside, and there was a demonstration led by Gloria Allred, who was like the lawyer, family lawyer for a lot of feminists for Michelle. She was leading a feminist organization for Michelle, and they had wonderful dialogues with them about whether Michelle Marvin, who changed her name, it was Michelle Traola Marvin, over Lee's objections, she changed it to Marvin, was a feminist heroine or not. It was a great discussion. Anyway, final thing before we start with today. When do you register for next semester?
Next month.
Okay, I want to spend a couple, before we should, if you have any questions about family law courses for next year or next semester, I'll answer them. Yeah, we'll answer them.
I would like to know about the family law policy and the child state.
Child, family, and state. Okay. I don't know about international family law. Who's teaching that?
Sorry.
Oh, she's back.
She's back. Okay. That's international
that's
family law.
That's a field. She wrote the book.
She wrote the book. It's about international. It's a pretty much straightforward substantive law course.
The fact
is covered. It covers international adoptions. It covers international
customs.
The Hague Convention.
Increasingly important part.
That kind of stuff. Okay. What was the second one? Child, family, and state. Who's teaching that? Yeah, that's child, family, and state. You've gotten some of that here when we discussed like a lot of the child protection stuff that we did, abuse and neglect, the division of responsibility between the Amish, the constitutional division of responsibility.
You really have gotten a fair amount of that here. Mm-hmm. The course, if you're interested, that you don't get here very much at all is juvenile justice. Because that tends to focus on juvenile delinquency. So child, family, and state has a fair amount of overlap with what we've done here. Juvenile justice, that course, has almost no overlap. Because I know when I teach juvenile justice, I focus on delinquency and not on the stuff that we do here. One course that you may not know that will be on the schedule that's not now is matrimonial drafting. Pete Rieger. Is it on the schedule?
No. Yes.
They will be.
It will be. It's a good idea.
He just agreed to do it.
He just did something.
He's done it before. He's done it before, and he's going to do matrimonial drafting. That's a writing course. You were asking about what writing courses. That's a writing course. He is excellent. He's a terrific matrimonial attorney. His office is 5 minutes away. He teaches valuation sometimes, and this semester coming up, he's going to teach drafting. Maria. I think it's just Maggie's a busy lawyer. It's like 6 to 8. I don't
know. That's where the family law policy seminar is. The family law policy seminar you need my permission for. It is, let me describe it. We do various projects that are related to statutes and drafting for family law policy. They vary from semester to semester. In previous years, we did a foster care, foster care education project, an education project for kids aged out of foster care. We've done the collaborative, we did the Collaborative Law Act. We're going to do, there's going to be a conference in the spring about youth violence and youth education at, we're doing the Ed School. It's going to be a report that's coming out of it. There's going to be research done for that report. It's a writing course, it's a research course, but it's an activist course. I'd be lying to you if I told you it wasn't. It's kept small,
but that's the reason it's good.
It's a broader form, focused,
project-driven course that you will do a lot of research and writing, focusing on a particular project, and you have to go out and interview people. It's very activist oriented.
It's an activist-oriented course.
It's
a quasi-clinical, but more, it's supposed to individual clients, it's policy-oriented kinds of stuff.
We brought an
education program for aging out kids. We brought aging out kids here. We tested it out. We do projects, you know. And what those projects will be are in definition. I know what some of them are. I mean, we have to keep redoing, working on the Collaborative Law Act. I know we're going to be doing this, and it's more like we meet once a week to review where we are, what we're doing, what needs to be done, and set work schedules. It's much more like a law firm operation than the typical class.
Yeah. It's a great opportunity to get the cutting edge of a lot of these fields.
My question is about, it's kind of a little bit of confusion on my own part. With these writing requirements, like your class, the Family Policy Seminar, that is an actual, you're writing a policy paper.
You're going to have to write something, yeah. So that satisfies writing one.
Now, with the matrimonial drafting, are you writing a policy paper at the end, or are you actually drafting papers?
You're drafting whatever.
You're writing two, isn't it?
Or is it skills?
Okay, I don't know the answer to that.
That's a writing requirement.
That's a registrar's office question. The difference between writing one and writing two is basically a policy paper is sort of like an article with footnotes, okay? Two is more, can be more skills oriented, can be a series of short papers, can be
like
a clinical type stuff.
You do enough writing in there, even though you're not writing a single paper. It really is, don't go by algorithms. It's whatever the registrar, registrar will know what they are.
I guess what I was asking was, I'd be interested in seeing that matrimonial drafting class. But if we're not actually drafting papers,
sure you are.
I'm going to draft a drafting class. That's what we do all day.
I didn't want to go into it, and then at the end it's like, oh, it's a policy paper.
That's a skills oriented drafting.
That's pure skills. You'll do a lot of drafting.
What else?
That's what Keith does for a living. Yeah. He'll teach. He's great. Yeah.
I was in
the
drafting class last year, but they had the drafting certificates that came out. So what we did was like put in the like actually representing a client. So it's actually like you're going to the court.
So it's a practical skills.
Yeah.
It's a practice.
A lot of litigation oriented.
Yeah, we recruited Keith Rieger to come here because of his practical expertise, and he's been teaching two courses, a valuation course, which is an excellent course.
If you're going to be a divorce lawyer.
If you're going to be a divorce lawyer, you need to know what things are worth. You know in New York what a particular problem that is with licenses having value, but anything else has all kinds of issues regarding, and he would bring in guest speakers every week. He was very, very well received for us. The other course he's teaching is matrimonial drafting. So it's very heavy on practical skills. It's very good.
Maria?
I think the question was that
That's correct. Writing one requires a full-time professor. Writing two can be skills-oriented in pieces and put by adjuncts. There is one other course I'll mention quickly, which is not a family law course. But there has been some interest expressed in this at various times. As you probably know, I do teach a skills-oriented depositions course. We're offering, I can't do unlimited numbers in that. Friedman and I offered it during the summer where we tied it to written discovery, so it was called Discovery 1, Discovery 2. And it's written, that Discovery 1 is written Discovery. Discovery 2 is a simulated depositions course. I'm offering the depositions course this semester. We're doing it at the New York Law School in combination with the NIDA program. You can't grant that still. But in the spring, there will be a depositions course in March over an intensive weekend, Friday night to Sunday.
What is
that? I don't know. We're not doing it because you're not around that. Right. I'm not doing it. Well, I can't. I'm just, yeah. All right. What's up?
Is there a prerequisite for that?
Civil procedure. No, just civil procedure. And you've taken that. You've taken civil procedure.
Do you give permission
or just no, that's, you don't need my permission. That one is whatever the registrar does to allocate priority.
And that's just like it's a weekend.
It's a very intensive weekend. You will be tired at the end of that week.
I don't know.
But one or two.
Do you register?
So it's one credit, and it's one skills credit, and it's not graded. But you will be dead.
Do you write a paper after?
No. You take depositions. You listen to lectures. You take depositions. You bring in actors and actresses to play clients. You take a piece of the deposition. You get critique. You take another piece of the deposition. You get critique. You take another piece of the deposition. You get critique. It's like an acting workshop.
And although I don't know when I'm going to do this, because Andy just told me I'm the only one that can do this.
I can do it. I'm Discovery.
Modern divorce advocacy.
I like that one.
May at some point be offered. I think you talked me into it. It is a weekend intensive skills course. It's the same kind of thing. Same model. We do, direct and cross and work with an expert. And this time, you have your actual client. Professional actors playing the role of your actual client that you will have to work through a mediation session. And it is one weekend, and you'll be there at the end, but you will learn.
And we also offer in the summer an introduction to child advocacy, which is, we call it training lawyer to represent the whole child. It's a 5-day intensive child advocacy training program on the NIDA model. And we bring in lawyers from all over the country, and there's a student section going on at the same time. So we got a lot of options. Your family. The good news is that there's a lot of family law. Oh, and don't forget the clinic. Okay. Either the mediation clinic.
In the spring, Andy's taking my civil procedure class because I'll be on leave. So I know if you want a refresher course, you can talk to personal jurisdiction.
Just wait.
We have done divorce.
Who forgot Mary?
There you go.
I love doing that stuff. Yeah, what?
We did your deposition 1, deposition 2 in the spring. You can offer that deposition 1 in the summer again?
Discovery 1 will be offered during the summer, and you can take 1 without taking 2, and you can take 2 without taking 1.
All right, we need to get going.
All right, anything else?
Great, last question.
Is Discovery 1 open this semester?
You mean the externship?
I don't think so.
Judge is awesome.
He's a good judge. I think it's no.
All right, any other questions? We're going to turn this over to Tina.
Yeah.
Anybody on the panel here?
Okay.
Come on up, guys.
You're on the panel. Could you come up? I know Rachel Moore is not out sick. So I was wondering if either Aniba or Jesse would mind coming up.
Aniba doesn't mind.
Aniba, come on up.
We were prepared for you. We come off.
I know some of you, but I don't know all of you.
There's a chair. There's a chair here. Just spread them out so everybody can sit.
So if you don't mind just going down, just for me, just so I know everybody's name down the line.
My name is Deanna.
Hi.
Mike.
Hi, Mike.
Michelle.
Jeff.
David.
Aniba.
David. Okay, if you don't mind, we'll start from, and I've already forgot your name.
Deanna.
We'll start from Deanna and go straight down the line. If you don't mind telling the class what court you went to and what matters were heard at that court.
Okay. I went to NACPA Family Court, and the matters that were heard the day that I was there was family laws of juvenile delinquency, child neglect, and some other stuff.
I went to Nassau Matrimonial Supreme. I went the day before Rosh Hashanah, so there wasn't much, but it was either scheduling, and I saw a couple of child custody cases.
I went to the Nassau County Integrated Domestic Violence Court, and so they do pretty much everything there. So I saw custody issues, charity, which was dropped, domestic violence, obviously, and there's also a bond issue.
I went to the Nassau Family Court, saw some drug treatment court, and a remand request. I'm not sure what it was.
What? I'm sorry.
A remand request? I don't know where they put some kid in jail.
I went to the Nassau Matrimonial Center, and there was a preliminary conference, a petition for spouse support, and an enforcement of child support.
I went to family court in Nassau County, Judge Greenberg, juvenile delinquency cases. There were multiple cases of parents who wanted their children back. And then also a few cases where minors admitted to what they had done. Thank you. All right, well, let's start with you, Eva. What was the first thing you noticed about your court? That not everyone was inside of the courtroom. Like, they had to bring in the kids separately. And I guess being in housing court before, I wasn't, I guess I just really cognizant of it, that, you know, no one was in the courtroom. Everyone came in separately. They had very specific places at the table where the parents were left to stand, where the child was to stand, and where the social worker was to stand. So that's the first thing I noticed.
Same question.
Yep.
I noticed that it was a pretty small court compared to the other courts that I was in. The courtrooms were pretty small, and it was like more like a homey type of atmosphere. And there weren't a lot of people there. You know, there wasn't a lot of proceedings going on. It's maybe not a lot of divorces in Nassau County.
Were you there the day before Rosh Hashanah?
No, I was there. Okay. Maybe it was just an off.
I think one of you had written that in your paper.
I guess the same thing. I know it's really small, a lot smaller than I expected. Very informal. I mean, I guess I was surprised also by the amount of, it's like three or four uniformed officers, two outside the room, two inside the room, like, which sort of seemed like it just created more tension and didn't seem like a, well, like everyone was kind of joking around and setting up the room, and it was very informal, and I guess I was surprised at that.
You said the security created more tension, you thought?
I agree, but I mean, it just sort of, I mean, it's just in the whole court itself. I mean, you walk in, there's cops outside, and all, you know, there's no, I just didn't expect that many uniformed officers to be around. It didn't seem like it created like a friendly atmosphere, not that there would be.
It's kind of contradicted. All right, I see. So maybe fewer would have been better.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I haven't been to that many courts, so I don't know if it was more than usual.
That was actually.
No. What court were you in?
Nassau County.
Nope. That's exactly what. We'll talk about that some. So why do you think all those security people are there?
I assume they have a lot of problems, and I assume
what kind of problems do you think they have?
Well, I assume that there's a lot of fights, and people are very. A lot of.
That's exactly right. I mean, they're with the. If you view the statistics, okay, family courts are dangerous places for staff and for judges. There have been instances of disgruntled litigants shooting at judges and around the country. If you remember last year in California, a family court judge was killed after a guy went crazy and basically started shooting people. As a result, and also post 9/11, security has been dramatically tightened. Okay. There's a cost to that, and that's pretty much what you're describing.
Criminal courts are a lot safer.
I'm going to open this up in the class, because I know some students did see some violence or outbreak of very emotional or heated events in family court. Does anybody want to talk about what they saw?
Well, I'm not.
like visit this time, but Charles was domestic violence court. I had described it to my police family courthouse a few times. Well, this happened one time, but I've seen fights more than once. One time, this woman came with her boyfriend, who she was seeking the order of protection against, and he dropped her off at the courthouse so she could get the thing. And she was taking too long, came in, started yelling at her, and then they started a fight there, and then they left together after the cops kicked them out.
It's a dangerous place. People's emotions are very high. Their level of dysfunction is very high. Their level of anger is very high. You've got people with a lot of what you would call, loose screws in their head going on here. There's a reason those usually get those orders of protection.
But at the Queen's Courthouse, I've been there many times, I've talked to some of the advisors, and they seem to be amazed at the types of weapons they take off people.
When we started the peace program in Nassau County, we had police night, which everybody who was getting a divorce in certain courtrooms had to go. We had police night, which was all the cops who were getting a divorce had to go. And, they went to the court. They had to put out all their guns before they went into the program. They had to go through the medical bed. Was quite high. So what the message also, of course, that you get in part is one price security.
Anybody else see anything? Anybody else want to comment on anything they saw? Yeah.
Not this time. I've worked at the juvenile family court, juvenile delinquency, and both with custody issues, I observed the parents that would be arguing each other and the officer had separated them, as well as in one of the proceedings that juvenile delinquent, the child became very violent and took like 3 or 4 officers to subdue him. So, I mean, they need to get extra people from outside the courtroom because there's only 2 officers in the courtroom. So you really need the extra people from what I've seen there.
Now we're back to what surprised me.
Yeah.
I guess I was surprised, about how informal it was, how small, kind of how unimpressive the courtroom was for the integrated domestic violence. When I went to Queens, it was a completely different experience and a completely different atmosphere. It just seemed like everything was really laid back. And the other thing that surprised me was how hard it was to find. I had a big runaround. Tina and I were told to go to the wrong place on the Unified Court System website. They had a different address. And then when I got there and I'm like walking around asking court officers, they were sending me in different directions and telling me like, oh, integrated domestic violence is in that building. And then I said the judge's name, and they're like, oh, that judge, no, that's in a different room. So apparently there's like different judges and different rooms in different courthouses. So I can only imagine what people who are going for the first time that have to deal with their family issues, how difficult it is for them to find them.
How was Queens different?
Queens was different because it was in the criminal court. There was one room. All the issues were handled there. And it was also just a lot more formal. It felt like, it felt like almost like a real courtroom. Whereas in Napa, it was like really informal. People were sitting around. Like the barrier between where, the audience sits and the tables were playing for the defendant, the attorneys were all sitting in front of that barrier, just hanging out, talking to each other on all different sides. Like family matters, criminal matters, they're all just sitting there talking and chatting away. Most of the stuff was done in chambers, and that wasn't like that in Queens either. And they didn't even have a court reporter like permanently in the room. It was just a very different experience.
I was also in the Supreme Court, and something that was kind of confusing to me was, I guess I expected something like a big courtroom, like you see on TV or something, because I don't have much experience in court, but when I went down, it was just in these tiny little corridors, and there was like plaques above each door that said, Judge Ross, Judge Brown, whatever, and you'd walk into these rooms, and there would be 2 little like rickety wooden chairs that you could sit down in and observe the court. But it was just very, like everybody's been saying, very informal. The room itself that I was sitting in was so tiny, almost claustrophobic. And there were just people walking in and out, talking in the back. I was just very surprised that the judge, let people continually walk in and out of the courtroom as it was going on. I was just very confused by that, but very informal.
Right, you said that was rude.
To me it was distracting for somebody trying to observe a courtroom setting, people walking in and out and making a lot of noise as they're doing it.
In fact, one time a guy just left the door open to the courtroom. You could hear everything people were saying in the hallways as the proceeding was going on. So I thought that was really not as formal as I thought it was.
I was surprised, disgusted, disappointed. This is my own personal opinion, at the lack of organization and professionalism. I went to family court, and I honestly just wanted to get up, and I was like, well, since everybody else is talking, let me talk about what's wrong here, you know? So it was like Burger King cups on the ceiling, there's some guy eating a peanut butter sandwich on the left-hand side corner, you know, there's people yelling in the hallway, the cops were, you know, oh, did you, how was last night? Really? Girl, where'd you go? And I'm like, what is this? Like, we are in court. I don't want to hear about your date from last night. Like, I was completely disgusted. Meanwhile, they're talking about the little date, and the judge is, like, you know, having this delinquency hearing, and this is, like, serious, and they're talking about their date, and this guy's eating peanut butter, and there's birds, and so I was completely disgusted. I left heated. I was so upset that day.
Well, let's talk about that. What image of justice are you getting here?
Of justice? There was no justice there. I mean, to me, the image of justice, that was not the image of justice. And to me, that was just, there can not be any justice, because how can you focus on the parties? How can you focus on the issue at hand when you have 10 different things going on and it's like a circus in the courtroom?
Okay. Now, Mike, you mentioned that the courtroom was really small.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Claustrophobic.
Yeah.
Okay. What image of justice do you get?
I mean, it was not what I expected at all. I mean, me personally, to enter into, you know, I thought I was going to enter into a big courtroom, you know, with big pillars and the whole nine yards. Yeah, you know, I guess I expected something totally different. But I walk in and there's like stacks of papers on the, you know, kind of to what she was saying about, like, you know, just like very messy, papers stacked, you know, almost to the ceiling. Just very, just, you know, like almost like a rundown kind of little like office room. It's very tiny. Yeah.
Michelle, you're shaking.
That's
your head.
What it seemed like, and it was just that in Queens, it was a formal courtroom. You couldn't talk while things were going on, and the attorneys wouldn't dare like have a conversation in front of the barrier with each other about, you know, their days and their careers. And this was like, then you got here, and people were chatting while the judge was actually, the few things that actually happened in the court, the judge would be talking, and people would be having side conversations. Occasionally, they were shushed and stuff, but it was like a completely different experience than the formality of the Queen's Court. It's the same type of courtroom, so it's not like the issues were different. The issues were the same, but it was just a completely different approach.
I don't know, Michelle, where is this place?
Mm-hmm. In Nassau or in Queens? In Nassau, it was in the county court, the first building closest to Old Country Road. But I mean, there's the two different buildings, and I guess it's in both of them, because apparently there was a courtroom in each of them, but they called it the county court.
Okay, I think it's important to understand something here, okay? Image matters, architecture matters, okay? The way you carry yourself matters, right? It does. And what to me, what you're talking about is a simple, a lack of resources. Have you been to federal court? When you see what there?
It's like the biggest building on Long Island. It's all white walls, together with big pillars, wood paneling,
carpeting,
Burger King wrappers, people kibitzing while they're just talking.
Why?
You see that in federal court?
You
see it once, and then that person will be hauled off.
Yeah.
Right.
I was going to say, even in terms of demeanor, I think having an environment like that, everyone who walked into the courtroom, or that little room that they call a courtroom, was wearing sweatpants, they were wearing sweatshirts, you know, even the way they walked in, like they didn't care. I mean, I wouldn't take it seriously if I walked into that. I wouldn't be scared. And I felt like, you know, these are all juvenile delinquency cases, and these kids are walking in their, like, hoodies and their sweatpants, and they don't, you know, they don't care. And why should they care? I mean, I feel like the court themselves aren't taking it seriously.
Why do you think that is?
Yeah, I have really strong feelings on it. I saw exactly what she saw. And to me, this has nothing to do with the people who are walking in. I feel like this is the responsibility of the attorney. The reason why I say this is because I feel like an attorney should zealously advocate for the client. The argument was made, Well, they don't have clothes. Okay, an attorney with an organization like Legal Aid, I know they have closets of clothes where you can pick the clothes out and they're different size and you wash them and then you give them to your clients. So they go in there looking nice. And I feel like part of the responsibility of the attorney is to counsel and advise your client to say, hey, spaghetti straps and stilettos, it's not, you know, going to go in the courtroom. Like, you really need to cover yourself up and you need to, you know, brush your hair and walk in presentable. And I understand the argument about being poor and stuff like that, but I really feel like there's organizations out there that they can help in that aspect.
But do you think it's, because I think it's censoring me that this is poverty. I can sense this is attitude. They dress that way because they dress that way because that's who they are, and no one has said to them that message you're giving is inconsistent with, you know, the rest of the
I don't think, I mean, I don't mean to say in that way. I mean, I think they don't dress, like, if I was to go to court, I know that I have to dress in, you know, whatever, business casual attire. But if they feel like they don't need to because of the way the court gives off that, you know, I feel like it's the court. I don't blame the children. And even not only the court, I blame the parents, too. I feel like the parents are walking in there with sweatpants and jeans and, like, you know, hoodies and stuff like that. And I felt like that was very inappropriate. And I think they're old enough to know that when you walk into a courtroom, that's not how you walk in. That's not, like, what are you teaching your child? So
the attorneys in my courtroom also, I think, one or two of them was in a suit. And there was a lot of attorneys because there's so many different matters. Maybe one or two of them was in a suit. The bail bonds attorney addressed the judge without a tie or a jacket, and he apologized for his appearance and said it was a last-minute thing, but he addressed the judge was like, oh, no, you know, it was nothing, and none of the rest of them had suits either, and it was just like that the informality was overarching. And I know that even in criminal court, I remember attorneys didn't always have a full suit on, but there was a different level of professionalism there than there was with these were the attorneys, and it's like they weren't even exhibiting a professional attitude.
Why? Why do you think?
I have no idea. And the thing is, it's the same issues, the same court, but just in different counties, and it was a world of difference. But I think it could be that, like,
in Queens, they dressed better.
Yeah, I mean, they were more. Yeah, you wouldn't have addressed the judge with no tie and no jacket, and I mean, and it was. I think that they did. I don't know. It could be the buildings themselves are drastically different. The courtroom itself was drastically different in design and structure, but I don't know if that was it. I was just in shock. I couldn't believe that.
Yeah, I mean, I think for these kids, though, that's inevitable. Like, for me and you to go to court, hopefully we'll go once, you know, unless we're prospective or lawyers. You know, if you go to court, you go once in your life, maybe, and, you know, so it has some importance to you. But these kids, that's part of their life. These kids can go over and over and over again, time after time. You know, every month they can get dragged in for all types of issues, and it loses some of the importance to them and some of the, you know, esteem that we generally give the court. So for them, it's just, you know, a regular day at work, so they don't feel the need to dress up.
Well, what you're diagnosing, to me, just a quick little set of background. Yeah, Nassau and Queens are different. They have different ways of appointing judges. They have different administrative structures. Okay? And the Queens judges for family court come through, are appointed by the mayor of the city of New York, and there is a merit selection process for those judges. They go through the City Bar Association, they get screened, whole bunches of things happen. Judges out here, courts are locally funded, judges are locally chosen and elected. Largely they are chosen out here by the political parties. The quality of the courtroom is largely established by the county budget. There is no legal aid juvenile rights division out here in Nassau County. There is in Queens. That has historically been a major force, institutional force, for upgrading the quality of advocacy. The institutional, because they're an institution, they're like a public defender or they're like a prosecutor, and they advocate for their clients on an institutional basis. And while they are overstretched and overstressed and all of that, those things, they're professionals. That's what they do. Here, we rely on ATB lawyers, who are independent practitioners and have varying ways of getting on the panel.
Some of them are excellent.
Some of them are fine.
And some of them are not.
Okay. So there are different things going on here. And yes, the exact same case, the exact same manner, okay, can be handled very differently, which is what you're saying, in different places.
Yeah, I just want to say, since you're talking about questions, I just am right now at the district court, and the district court's a joke.
They were here?
Yeah, in Hempstead. District court's a joke. It was a building that they, it was an office building that they just kind of renovated and made into a courtroom. There's no separate entrance really for judges. There's no separate, like, everybody's just kind of wiggling in. The criminals are brought in the same way as the judges. There's one elevator for judges and criminals and employees. So criminals take preference. And there's no staircase in the back judges' chamber, so the judges can even get out, like, from one level to the other. You have to take this one elevator.
The court buildings in Nassau are abominable. I haven't got the other thing I could say about them. The Supreme Court building is okay. The satellite buildings are ridiculous. And look where the family court is, and look where the Supreme Court is.
But now in Queens, who went to Queens Family Court? Who's been there? Anybody been to Queens Family Court? Okay, that's a new, to me, new building. My wife, who was a longtime JRD attorney,
right,
worked in the old building and then in the new building. She said it was night and day. And the point, what she pointed out was, you had no place in the old building to talk to your client. You kind of just kind of like huddle in the hallway. The new building has some different rules to do that. So that architecture matters. I'm going to echo Andy's point. But these things don't just happen. Someone must have lobbied and raised the money, and the Queens Family Court is a dramatic difference from the original Maria.
I believe that's true of Brooklyn. We were always going to the Family Court, and it's actually the Family Court. So now it's really nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I disagree about what Deanna said about it being the responsibility of the attorney earlier. When I went to court, there's no family court in Georgia. They have, at least not the county that I was in, they have everything together. So they have criminal and everything. So they would break, they broke the divorce case, they reset that, and then they heard this drug case. And the person that came up there, I mean, I don't know if she was a user or what the situation was, but she looked a mess. I mean, and that's in the Bible, though. She would never go to church like that, I can guarantee you. She had on, like, a mid-gym shirt, and her hair was all, you know, just all over her head. It was really a matter of poverty. I just think it's a matter of respect. And like I said, in the Bible Belt, she would never have walked into church like that. So I think it's not, I don't think it's education either. I just think it's a matter of respect. I just think
But let me ask you to address Deanna's point, though, as I heard it, which is, it's the lawyer's job to say to the client, we're going to court tomorrow.
Well, you know,
what are you going to look like when you go to court tomorrow?
Right.
Let's describe, you know, because we need to talk about making a good impression. I mean, you don't disagree with that?
No, not at all. I don't think ultimately it's their responsibility. I mean, you can't dress the person. So you don't know whether, I mean, I find it hard to believe that they don't have that conversation, especially if they come to their office looking a mess, or when they go see them, they look a certain way. I can't believe that an attorney doesn't say that, but ultimately it's not, I mean, the attorney can't be responsible for it. I think they're responsible for putting that across.
Yeah, I think you're true. I'm not sure they are having, I'm not sure the attorneys will show up with no shirt, you know, no tie, are having that conversation with their clients. I'm not sure.
I worked two summers in juvenile delinquency in California, police have a family court, it's actually in criminal court, and most of the time it was very formal. In L.A. there were actually kind of murals on the wall, like encouraging words and stuff, but in, you know, it was not, it was like in the adult criminal court, just a different courtroom. And so it was quite formal, and we instruct all of our clients to tuck in their shirt. Most of the time you meet your client on the day they're appearing in court, so you can't figure out what size they are. Kids are all different sizes. You can't provide them with shoes or a jacket or a sweater, really. We didn't have any clothes in the juvenile one because they're not going to trial. Because the judge is judging them, they won't change them out of their juvenile hall gear. They won't take the cuffs off them because they say the judge can see past that. Whereas the reason you address your clients appropriately is for the jury. And so
a lot of times we were provided with funding for that. They wouldn't take cuffs off the kids. They wouldn't take them out of their juvenile hall jumper. And so the most we could do is tell our kids to tuck in their shirt or wear long sleeves if they had tattoos in their arms. Sometimes we wouldn't let the parents in if the parents had a lot of tattoos on, just because we think it would hinder the kid. But, you know, a lot of times you meet the kid the first time there and they only come back one more time. And you don't have the resources to call them the day before and make sure they have the proper clothes. And some of them actually don't have the clothes. But, yeah, I mean, we do advise them, you know, to look presentable, but you can only do so much.
Steve, and then we'll let's move on.
But I think there's a little bit of difference. Like, yeah, you can't enforce that because that's criminal defense. Like, they come the way the court officers bring them from the prison.
You can get your clothing. A lawyer can provide, or family members can provide clothing. Every criminal defendant has the constitutional right to be dressed the way Baker looks, right?
But I see a difference between that and in a custody case, a mom just rolling in with cleavage showing, a short skirt and high heels, or a guy without like a ripped shirt or. And the judge, I think, should enforce that. I mean, with maybe different with criminal defense, and maybe security reasons, you don't want to take the cuffs off.
You say the judge should enforce it how?
Judge should kick them out of the courtroom. Say,
dress code in the courtroom.
Dress code in the courtroom. Make the attorneys wear certain clothes. Because it, no, if you walk into federal court in jeans and a t-shirt and try to talk to a judge, would he speak to you, or would he?
I would not dream of walking into that courtroom.
Because a lot of you have hit the theme of formality versus informality. Okay, we don't discuss In re Gault here, okay, because that's actually reserved for the juvenile justice course, pretty much, but. There is a long tradition of the following idea. Family matters should be heard informally. Okay? Less intimidating, less procedure, less judges, bring people out. Okay? The reason I'm talking about In re Gault is, those of you, this is, I think, the 16th anniversary of Gault, isn't it? It was a landmark. The juvenile court used to be, when is it? When was it?
God. We passed the 40th a couple years ago. You're about two decades
ago. Whatever. Gerald Gault was a kid in Arizona. Basically, he allegedly made an obscene phone call. He was basically brought into court, no lawyer, no charges, no transcript. Right? Since they wound up with 5 years in juvie, in essentially prison. Right. So the idea was, the defense to that was, well, this is an informal proceeding, we're trying to rehabilitate him. Supreme Court, ultimately, the real Supreme Court, not the New York State Supreme Court, said, ultimately, look, he's not getting rehabilitated, he's going to juvie, he's not getting any rights, okay, he's not getting a lawyer, he's not getting a transcript, he's not getting a jury trial, he's not getting due process, this is unconstitutional.
And it's not rehabilitating anybody.
It's not rehabilitating anybody. So then in came the idea that we had our procedure, okay, that's relatively new with juvenile cases. It's relatively new also, the idea that we had our procedure in child protection cases is relatively new. Okay. The notion that there's legal rights at stake here, okay, in the family part, not the criminal part, it's relatively new. Okay. And what you're reacting to in part is a residue of the old ways of doing business in the family court. Okay. A lot of statements are made about family court. Social work, it's not law. Okay? You're not real judging. Okay? It's not a real courtroom. It's all these dysfunctional people who don't deserve any support or help from anybody. Okay? I hear this all the time in various places. People who practice family law are not real lawyers. Okay? Dare I say this? Don't yell at me. It's women's work. Don't yell at me. there's no money. It keeps piling on. And what you're describing in many ways is attitudinal, that reflects the social priority that is placed on the legal system that deals with families and children. Okay? When you get a new court like you please, okay, that says kids and the parents who come here matter. And the judges who are before them are professionals, and they'll be dealing with them. And the lawyers are going to be dealing with them are professionals. Just like when you go to a crappy hospital. You know you're in a crappy hospital, right? And you know when you're in a good one. Real quick. Pick it up like that. Is it organized? Okay. Do they have, is it well lit? Is somebody greeting you there professionally? Right? And you know that. You know what you're in. Okay. That's what's going on here. Okay. Now, do we have magic bullets that can solve that? No. Yeah, I mean, I got some ideas. But the first thing is awareness of what's causing this and what the problem is. They would never tolerate the crap we're talking about here in family in federal court. Never. I mean, the notion, my first federal case was Jack Weinstein. I can imagine if I walked in, you, out, bailiff, arrest him, right? If I walked in that way. There was dead silence in those courtrooms. Dead silence, I promise you. And you only speak when spoken to. Yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to address your statement about the quality of the courtroom earlier. Well, I think that's true, and there's a lack of funding. So, you know, the court systems are poor and can't really raise a new building. I think there's things, like Karen addressed, of just respect, like, I don't think it would take too much to get a bunch of attorney volunteers or law school students or clinic to help scrub those floors and take the gum off the table, get the cups off the little seals and file those papers. I don't think it's too much to ask the court to be clean. I mean, just because you're poor doesn't mean you have to be dirty. So I feel like just because the court system has no funding doesn't mean they have to be so nasty about the process. It's just despicable the way it looks.
Yeah.
I was just saying, law school clinic, honestly, like, as a student, I wouldn't think a clinic that was having me, like, I'm paying for the law. Although this is something that I guess would be important, but me personally, I wouldn't take a class to go clean.
Well, I brought that up because our clinic actually did go to the court and we figured this out, and we actually did want to volunteer to clean up the courtroom. So I think it's on an individual clinic basis, but, you know.
I actually love the idea, but I have some real concerns about it. I'd rather picket the courtroom and have rather than clean it up for them. Government's supposed to do that. Government's supposed to do that.
There's no way that Napa County has, like, as a county, should have substantially less money than Queens as a county. It's really just, like, how the funding is being allocated, but it's not designated.
Nassau County is one of the two or three richest counties in the United States.
Yeah.
Okay, hold on. I think we're losing the thread. Let's give the ball back to Tina. Let her run.
Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Court procedure. I think it seems very routine, and I think maybe that's one of the problems is that it's becoming too much of a routine to have these cases, so we kind of just, like, start giving up, you know, start losing the tie, and I feel like as far as procedure goes, I don't know, I mean, I didn't notice anything too different with each of the different cases, because I seemed like everything was kind of just, like,
can you describe the routine that you saw, what seemed so routine?
Well, when the officers came in, they picked the tables, did what they needed to do. You know, everyone did everything, and then the judge kind of just walked in. But it's not like when the judge walked in, everyone was silent, and, you know, they announced the judge walking in. The judge kind of just walked in. And then when the clients or when each party walked in, the lawyers and the social workers were kind of allowed to come and go, but the parents and the children weren't. And they were made to wait in the waiting room or outside in the hallway, and I thought that was a little weird because if their lawyer can walk in, why can't they walk in with their lawyer? So, I mean, each side would kind of just come in and
do their case. And sometimes, I guess towards the middle, they did allow other attorneys on other cases to sit in the back, meaning the two rows of broken auditorium seats that were in the back. And that's it.
In terms of the procedural issue, like you were discussing, it seemed pretty standard. In terms of like actual proceedings of the court, that I thought was a little uncoordinated, at least to me. It took me a while for that to figure out what was going on, like what type of hearing it was. And I don't think I was the only one confused. There was one time the judge got up there and he said, okay, this is an order to show cause. And the husband's attorney said, no, it's not. This is something else. And then the wife's attorney said, actually, we're here because they didn't pay child support. And it just seemed like you could just say whatever you wanted. And then it actually morphed into something else when they were discussing a totally separate issue about turning off the water in the marital residence. And they were fighting about that for an hour, which had nothing to do with anything that they were discussing originally. And it seemed to me that it was just,
right?
Yeah. It just seemed that it was just do what you want, free for all.
I guess for me, I thought procedure was, I think it's a lot of times up to the judge to sort of set the tone of the courtroom, regardless of what people look like, and this whole discussion that we had. I know when nobody was talking, nobody was, while things were going on, it was very, he sort of stepped up to the table and he had everybody introduce themselves and he announced what the matter was, and then they sort of just went through it, and there wasn't really any problems. Things didn't sort of disintegrate into what you were talking about there. But
where are you?
That's a family. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So it ran pretty smoothly from what I saw. There weren't problems like what everyone else was talking about, and everyone seemed to know their roles, and everything went pretty well.
Were you before Judge Dane?
Yes.
And in your paper, you said something interesting about his court procedure. Is that how he dealt with the party?
Oh, yeah. I think that he was, he was sort of, he was very informal. In drug treatment court, I guess it's sort of combination of therapy and actual court procedure. He started with, he joked, he made a joke, and I don't remember what it was, but everybody laughed. But I don't know if it's funny. and then
his jokes were always.
when they all announced, the first thing they would start with is they would announce whether they had tested positive or negative. I guess if they had tested that day or the day before, and everybody clapped if they were negative, including the lawyer from social services. Which was pretty interesting. And so it was really, so it really wasn't like, it was like a court proceeding, it was like therapy, and it was very.
This is drug court, right?
It was like, so it was kind of interesting, and, I clapped along, and felt like they were going to make it. On an individual basis, he would actually, talk to people in a more serious manner. One woman was pregnant, and he sort of, changed manner with her very much and was very serious and said, to her that the only way she was going to keep the baby was if she stays clean. And so he sort of went back and forth between, needing to be forceful and needing to be sort of, more of a therapist. So I thought it was, I thought it ran really well. I thought he did a great job.
They usually send judges who really want to be there to the drug treatment courts, and then get special training. Remember, we started this semester by discussing the role of the family court. What you're describing is kind of the typical problem-solving court. Okay? The people in that court wave into it. Right, they're there voluntarily, as voluntarily as they can be. As opposed to going to jail, but they don't have to be there. They could go through the standard criminal justice system and go to trial, and they wave in. They waive a lot of legal rights. Okay, they waive but the idea is, it's exactly as you described it. It's a therapeutic court. Okay, so the idea is, he's both a cheerleader you're doing great, you know, and so forth. And also, though, if somebody gets off track, he's a punisher. Right? So he's got dual roles in a lot of ways, and it is a model that has swept the nation, the drug court model in particular, and also has actually proven pretty effective. I mean, it's better than the criminal in terms of generating rehabilitation. So it's a different role for a judge. I mean, he's not sitting there as a neutral, detached finder of fact. He's sitting there as the combination cheerleader and therapist in chief of those judges, and also adjudicator. If they screw up, he sends them, they're responsible for them. So that's in part what's going on there. It's a different role. It's not the Gault role, and it's not the role of the adjudicator. It's not the federal court role either. It's the problem-solving court role, and that's what you're describing.
But in a larger umbrella, let's step back. All courts are moving in the general direction.
Yes.
Even in the federal courts, what you're seeing is that the courts are becoming managers. They are case managers with the summary judgment. The high use of summary judgment, especially after Celotex, to be able to knock that down, and the whole variety of things, the introduction to the federal system of a lot of mediation, a lot of other dispute resolution methods, the courts have become managers. I say that, that's not a family court issue, but I just didn't want you to think that what Andy was describing is purely in the family law world. That is a larger kind of a sea change that's occurring throughout the legal system as a whole.
Said
there's a difference between.
Yeah, there's a difference in that most of everything that went on happened in chambers, and then they would come out, find a court reporter, bring a court reporter into the room, and just basically go on the record to say, this is what kind of, it seemed like they basically, this is what we agreed to on, and this was on all the different issues. This is how they did their criminal issues and their matrimonial issues.
Where were the litigants?
They were out, like, in the part where I was in. So everything was happening in chambers with the attorneys. Then the attorneys would come back and forth, grab their client, go outside in the hallway, have quick hush discussions, come back in, and go back in. And from what I saw, it may have been more effective, I don't know, in achieving results, but I felt like for the people, it just felt like you were getting these hush discussions, and they didn't really understand what was going on in terms of the process. They were like, well, what about this? Well, what happened? You know, they didn't really understand what was happening. It was like, these decisions are being made behind, almost like behind their backs, and they came out and said, okay, this is the result. This is the best thing you can agree to. This is the best choice that we have. And a lot of the clients seemed very, like, frazzled by it and upset by it, and I didn't even hear people being like, oh, I see our attorney. You know, like, things like that, because it was like, the attorney might have really been doing the best thing they could for their client, but since they're not seeing the process, they're not really sure that their attorney is saying these things that they wanted them to say.
What you're articulating here is the single biggest criticism of lawyers and family court. I mean, it's you know, they... This is sort of divorce court, too? who's in this? Again, tell me.
It's everything. It's matrimonial, custody, child abuse and neglect, domestic violence.
So you got to picture this, okay? You've got people who are intensely emotional, right? They're invested. This is the stuff that's most important to them in their lives, okay? Their lawyers go into a place. They don't see what's going on. There's no transparency, okay? And the lawyers come out and say, here's what you got to agree to. And what would you think? You saw that. Okay. What you're describing is why so many people push mediation, okay? Push voice, okay? Push the idea of participation. It's probably the best outcome they're going to get, but since they haven't participated in it, they don't know that. That's really sort of the core of the underlying problem. There are alternative ways of looking at those, of dealing with those problems and dealing with the situation that would give them more input and voice. But what you're describing is, in every survey, what people hate about their lawyers. They're doing things to them. There's a conspiracy between the lawyers and the judge to get this settled. If you're in emotional distress, okay, the last thing you want is some. The last thing you would agree to is somebody going into a closed room and saying, "You're going to do this, right? You got to work it through." And if you don't participate in working it through, you're not going to buy in. And that's, you know, so when you folks go into practice, if any of you ever do, remember that. Okay. If you can figure out a way to involve your clients in the decision making and get the information to them and the perspective to them, explain to them what's going to happen, okay, you will have clients coming out of the, you'll have grateful clients and you'll have many more clients, those who are satisfied. And that's in large part.
Yeah, the other thing about too is that when they didn't feel like they were okay with the decision, but then all of a sudden now they're on the record and they'd have the clients being like, well, wait a minute, no, this isn't what I, you know, like, and they're arguing back and forth and now they're on the record and now it's all, like, it's kind of a lot more, I guess, serious at that point. And so it was like bad for the attorneys too, and then they had their clients being like, no, this is what you told me, this is what my last attorney told me. And one of the cases involved, like, this girl who said when she took a conditional plea and she violated the terms of that, and but she was convinced that her attorney had told her the terms were different, you know, whenever it was that she took it 2 years ago or something like that. So she was arguing about this point once they had gone back on the record and still admitted that her last attorney had lied to her. So I'm sure that being that, you know, she supposedly didn't trust to her last attorney and then she was having all these, like, fraudulent proceedings. And especially since there's so many different issues, sometimes they had different attorneys coming back to talk to them about different things and they had so many issues going on that it was probably really overwhelming for them.
I guess to touch on, like, the emotional aspect of the whole thing, like, obviously, I saw, you know, every case I saw I had to deal with divorce, whether it was support, custody, whatever. But one of the things I noticed was, in terms of the emotion, that there was one case I saw, and the husband had a restraining order put against him by the wife, former wife. And he was just like, you know, they stepped up in front of the judge, and you can almost, like, feel the tension between them, and they're standing, like, literally, like here's him, and here, like, she's standing right here. So it was just like, you know, it's an emotional time for them, and something I noticed when I was, like, sitting in the back of the courtroom, I felt the judges who communicated more with their clients really, you know, made them feel more at ease. It's a very high tension, you know, thing that you're going through. You're getting divorced with somebody you might have been married to for, you know, say 20 years. So it's important that they know exactly what's going to go on, exactly what the procedure is going to be. And I felt like the most effective lawyers that I saw that day had really good rapport with their clients. Really explain to them, this is what the judge is going to say, this is what's going to happen when I go and speak with the judge. And you could really notice the difference between the clients who felt at ease from what their lawyers were telling them and those who had virtually no communication at all with their lawyers.
Procedurally, I thought that the judge could have done a better job of explaining the system to the child. I felt like there was a lot of confusion that was going on with the child. And, 3 out of 4 children I saw started crying. And I think it was some of confusion, some remorse, some of the frustration. But particularly there was one child that I didn't know, had no clue what was going on. They spoke Spanish. It was clear they didn't know English. The judge is throwing all these terms about waiver and residency and treatment and do you understand what I'm saying? And the child was so confused. There was no interpreter. And I was just kind of disappointed to see that the cases that I saw, I just felt like the children had no understanding of the courtroom procedure as to what was happening with their case.
You made a good point in your paper. You said that that was very...
Page 2.
It was about... Oh, it might have been... It was Rachel. She's asked one of the reasons why I had her up on the panel. That it was found that the minor was using marijuana, a substance that stays in one's system for at least 1 month. I wonder whether or not the minor knows how long the substance stays present in her system, and if not, how she should become competent to answer if she could test positively or negatively as asked by the judge. We really don't know if it's answering yes to what she ever advised, how long that drug stays in your system before she answered the judge's question.
Yeah, so that's exactly what, there were these complex compound questions that were directed to this particular child, and I could tell the attorney was like saying one word in Spanish that was completely wrong because I'm bilingual and I could understand what was going on, and the child was like, pero yo no entiendo, and which means I don't understand, and I'm like, oh my gosh.
Why wasn't there a Spanish interpreter?
I have no clue. I have no idea.
That's just
out.
Do you think the judge
that's
was like
learning
in another language?
You know, because it was such a circus in there, I don't even know, you know, if she would have had the opportunity to attack the situation. But to me, as an observer, I found
I thought Judge Greenberg did a good job of explaining before. There were two children there who were admitted to what they had done. And before either of them had, you know, admitted to anything, the judge laid out, you know, all the rights for them. She basically had the speech ready for them, and she sat there and she explained it to them, and she made sure the children understood. But at the same time, I felt like the kids were kind of just admitting because that's what their mom, dad, or lawyer had told them to do. So no matter what was coming out of the judge's mouth, they kind of already knew what they had to say in terms of response. But I did feel like, at least in Judge Greenberg's chambers, she did explain it to them.
How about the rest of you?
Some of the attorneys explained, I think, better than others what was going to happen, but I think it still felt like some people didn't really completely, some of them weren't represented, actually. So there was that, too. And so I felt like some of them kind of felt like they knew what was going on, some of them didn't. And then also we had the situation of people that weren't represented, they were pro se, so they were allowed to go back to chambers, but their spouse, who was represented, wasn't in chambers. So I think that could have also been a little bit of a confusing thing for people.
Can I pick up the theme? Did anybody else see pro se litigants in your courtrooms?
Nobody?
On that day,
rather. Pro se litigants, and what differences you observe? I'd just be curious.
What do you see, folks?
She being the wife.
The judge.
The
judge is in the position of the wife and the husband. And I don't know what the husband's saying. Both of them are really emotional. And it took like a really understanding the judge. And she actually almost like explained to him that she was doing the right thing by coming to the settlement. But it was just such an emotional thing that came from me. After it, I went back and she was with her. And she had said, like,
I'm
Okay. Okay. So lawyers matter, right?
But actually,
I'm sorry.
Well, I mean, when we went, there weren't many substantive issues. It was just coming to settlement or like agreeing to, you know, the terms of the agreement, settlement agreement. But what we didn't notice is that there were a lot of differences, and I think that it was due to cost, and also you could tell, you know, are you represented? Or do you want to be represented? But some of them would just say, like, you could kind of sense some of the discussions. But the judge, it was Judge Greenberg, and she was doing the civil procedure, and she really controlled the show. And the lawyers didn't seem to make that big of a difference, but there was no substitute. There is a substitute.
Okay, thanks,
Jen. I went to Brooklyn for Dead Sunshine, and then Hofstra Adams, so it was really exciting. So there was a husband and wife. The husband earned, you know, a substantial income, but he had an attorney, and the wife did not have one. And when he inquired, you know, why do you have an attorney, she said, really, she wants to give it to a senior property, you know, a teacher, whatever. And then she instructed her that she can apply to have her husband pay her attorney fees. And then he also told her husband's attorney that if she needs an application and she was denied, then he would have to give her a written decision why he denied the fees. So he thought, I think, to the husband's attorney's money, less cost than trying to just have to pay the fees.
Sunshine's a good judge. Really good judge.
Be a little sleight of hand.
So with all the judges I talk to, okay, they actually say something like the following. Their first choice is to have two lawyers. Their second choice is to have two pro ses. The worst for them is one pro se and one lawyer. Okay, that's because of what you're basically talking about, because they have a great deal of difficulty trying to figure out how much help they should give the pro se. Without stepping over the line of judicial neutrality, like Sunshine basically saying to him, okay, get her a lawyer, please, quick, right? And, you know, and he's saying to him, you know, I'm going to grant this motion and we'll be happy, and, well, you know, so get him a lawyer, get her a lawyer.
And imagine the frustration in Jess's courtroom of the judge who's got a pro se litigant out of control. You would be so tempted to say, shut up, sit down, don't say another word. But what have you just done? That's reversible error, isn't it? You can't tell a litigant, you're not telling a litigant, you can't tell the entire side. There's no lawyer. So your temptation to either help them out, which is violates your partiality rule, or shut them down, which could lead to
reverse disaster.
Yes, he helps them out a lot.
Trying to do the discovery with them, trying to get, I mean, it is just a nightmare. Your client ends up spending more money to just get to the point that you can get to a trial, and they are so unresponsive, they're enough for me to pull out your hair. And then by the time you do get to trial, you do want to help them because you want to make it go as smoothly as possible for everybody. It's very difficult.
See, all the stuff you've heard about bad lawyering here, okay, lawyers actually still do some really valuable work. Like helping the courtroom run. Okay, and so there's a real tension here, and more people are not getting lawyers, in part because people aren't explaining the procedure. But when the lawyers do participate, they can be, they're very valuable at various times. It's kind of like a not one thing. You can't condemn everybody or her. It just doesn't work. Yeah.
In Queens, actually, even when they were doing the matrimonial matter, because someone was pro se, the judge told them to get a lawyer and ask if there was like a public defender or an ATV lawyer in the room, even if they were in the room because they were there for the criminal matter. He asked them to step in and just assist them with whatever hearing they were having.
Get out! Somebody wants to assist you.
Yeah, they said, can you just stand in for this hearing and advise him on that?
It's
and then said, you have to get a lawyer. Unless you can show that you cannot afford a lawyer, you have to get a lawyer.
That's technically not true.
I don't know if he was able to do that, but I mean, that's what he said to them, and he let the public defender find them a matrimony letter.
Why is it, folks, and this is something for you to ponder, okay, that there's these increasing numbers of pro se's?
Because the economy's so bad.
That would presumably, no, it happened when it was a rich economy too, and presumably, why is this? I mean, I got poor people, okay? I'm not legal aid. I understand that, right? But why should somebody who's got some not paid their lawyer, I mean, if they could, but yeah.
In my opinion, working in the law office, because you're kind of like a fly on a wall, like you're in the room listening to talk to clients, they just, a lot of the times, they're kind of like disrespectful, but they talk with, like, such an arrogance, like that they're smarter than you, and you forget that a lot of clients don't have any idea what you're talking about. And I think that's a part of it. At least the lawyers I've worked for, they were a huge jerks. If I was a client, I'd probably go walk out.
So what is poor communication skills? This is up here. Right? What else? What's going on here?
You ask somebody.
Yeah, what's going on?
I know people who've done it pro se, and for the reasons, A, number one, they think they can do a better job than the attorney, that they can get themselves what they want more. B, they don't want to pay because they think it's going to be absurdly even more expensive than going through a divorce, and they think they're going to get ripped off.
And what would you do if you, let's assume that was market research, okay, which is pretty much confirms what I tell you here. What would you do if you were a lawyer to combat those things? What would you do?
They were excessive. It's just that they thought that they weren't getting them what they wanted, and that it was kind of a waste of money. If they're not going to get what they want anyway, then they'll show up and do it themselves.
So what would you do? What would you do? You're the folks going to be practicing. What would you do? What would you do?
When I'm in practice, I would like to incorporate some sort of educational piece with my client. Maybe perhaps within the first consultation, like kind of explain procedure to them so they have an understanding of what's going on and they're not so naive throughout the process. I don't know how that would work, but I know in clinic, we've had a very difficult time with our pen case because the parents and the children are so uneducated on the pen case. We as the mediators actually have to step back and teach them because we need to mediate because there's so much going on. So things like adding some sort of educational piece, whether it's 10 minutes or an hour, depending on the need, just educating them on the procedure, the words, the jargon, stuff like that, I think would be really helpful.
I have a friend who's a divorce lawyer in Los Angeles, Woody, and he knows him very well, who considers himself to be the education of the client to be like the number one thing he does. He says he's organized his office, Ben Bintritz in Los Angeles, with 100, I think he said, of different pamphlets. He has a client education room in his law firm. And he considers education of the client to be his number one job. And that's absolutely true because so often what you hear is lawyers and clients are not talking the same language. We're not actually communicating, whether because we're on our end we're stuck in the jargon, the lingo, or we really don't know the answer, so we can hide behind, habeas corpus because if you say Latin, it doesn't sound funny. Or for whatever reason, but you know what? It's our job to communicate effectively and make sure that it's beginning.
And
that's what I was going to say. Like, I think it's very easy to get jaded, especially in their field, you give up easily, and I feel like if the lawyer does that, then you can't, what do you expect out of their clients, and why would more people want lawyers if they
you know, kind of put off that kind of attitude, like, I know it all, I'm just do it and get it over with, like, I really don't care. And I feel like if we're trying to change this entire system, it starts with us, where we have to be more cognizant of the way we portray ourselves, the way we handle our cases, the way we handle our clients, and the way we present ourselves to future clients. Because right now, if they're up to me, I mean, I guess it's a little different for me, but I wouldn't hire a lawyer if, like, I felt like they were doing off the same vibe that many lawyers do today. And I feel like that's probably one of the biggest problems that we have, is that we're just so jaded by what's going on around us that we just kind of give in and just, like, make it into, like, an everyday routine. You know, we don't really care what we're doing, just get on with the formalities. That's
it.
I just said about Penn and Billing, see, some I just saw last week at my externship in district court. This is not through Penn and Law, but we had a person that came for a victim and people of judgment, and, well, she was supposed to be represented by an attorney, but her attorney hadn't shown up yet. She got it vacated. Then the attorney shows up when calendar call was closed, and we were all just BSing still in the courthouse with the court officer. And the attorney walks in and brings the client back in, and he allows the reopening of the court, which I'm not even sure we technically all do after the calendar closes. But then the lawyer starts arguing about he wants to get the whole thing dismissed. He didn't just want the summary judgment vacated. And then my judge says to him, "You never filed a notice of appearance." And he says, "You don't have to do that. No judge ever cares in this courthouse." And he starts yelling at my judge about this notice of appearance. And from what I understand, notice of appearance is the first thing you have to do before you can even speak in a courtroom.
Absolutely.
Right. And this guy is just screaming at the judge that why aren't you throwing this out? And he starts trying to litigate. He shows up 3 hours late. He gets yelled at by the judge. And then as he's walking out, he says, "Oh, that judge didn't know anything. Do you have the certified check for me?" to the client.
Well, there are bad lawyers in the world. Wow, that's scary. Folks, you know, you are painting a picture of a grim picture. Okay. You need some hope here. Okay. I'm not saying it's good. Okay. But you really do need to understand some things. I mean, I don't know how to help you get that. It's kind of what
Yes.
There is an honorable career here. Okay. Everything depends on you and your reputation and the way you carry yourself and your attitude towards your clients and the court system. You convey cynicism, they will be cynical. You are cynical, they will be cynical. Okay? The world is not perfect. No one says that. And people with family problems are particularly vulnerable to difficulties, paranoia, and cynicism. The remedy to that is usually more information and more empathy rather than less. I mean, I haven't got any other things to tell you about. But what I can say to you is, and I talked about, you know, now... Yeah, it is true that there is a declining number of people who want to use lawyers, particularly for family problems. Okay? I honestly think most of them are making big mistakes. Okay? They're making big mistakes because what they want is really usually not legally possible. Okay? And they need somebody to tell them that and to help set realistic expectations and help them get that. The critical thing to me is ultimately for you to be able to convey that information in ways that are not the condescending difficulties that you're describing. Okay. That's really kind of what you got to work on. And we've got to work on that as a profession and together. There is nothing better. Here's the flip side. If you represent kids, there's nothing better than forever, for example, getting a kid adopted. Wonderful. Something to remember for the rest of your life. Okay. There's nothing better than arranging a marital settlement between squabbling people that needs a kid
shielded from the squabbling?
Nothing.
Okay. I mean, maybe winning presidential election or something. Quite good. It's really quite wonderful to be able to do that. And what I don't want you to get the idea is that because there are outside forces causing disrespect for the system and the informality, that there isn't valuable and important work to do here. That's internal. That's got to ultimately come from you to figure out what to do.
Your practice norms are your worst practice norms. The worst thing about what Steve's story was when the lawyer said, Judges in these states don't require notice of appearance. The answer is, it doesn't matter whether they do or they don't. You file a notice of appearance because you're a lawyer, and that's the professional way of doing it. End of discussion.
Can he even charge you money about that?
We don't know.
No. Don't worry about it.
It sounded like you described about 10 or 11 different things that get wrong in that group. But anyway. But the point is, don't fall into the, maybe in a jurisdiction where the practice norms are pretty sloppy. That's no excuse. In a jurisdiction where the practice norms are very formal. You know what? You shouldn't be able to tell the difference. I should be able to walk into any courtroom where any of you are practicing 5 years from now and look at you and not know which jurisdiction you're in. Because I should be able to look at you and see how you practice, because your norms have to be internal. You practice on the basis of your pride of craft. Because you're committed to your clients. Because otherwise, you shouldn't be here. And all of you are here, and I've heard, I've talked to all of each of you. You're here because you want to be here. You're here because it matters. Well, it's going to matter now, and tomorrow, and in 5 years from now. And the way you show that it matters, yes, it's tacky things like dressing appropriately. Okay, that's important. Not as important as other things, but it's important as a baseline. Filing the notice of appearance before you open a mouth of court. Communicating with your client, because that's how you hold yourself out as somebody who can go home at the end of the day, look yourself in the mirror and say, I didn't get everything I wanted, but I'm proud of myself today.
Let me ask you one other question. Did you see anything during the course of your arbitration that you admired?
What did
you see that you admired?
You did, yeah.
Oh, I guess a couple of things. I mean, I thought on one particular woman in the drug treatment court, she told the judge, she I guess she was there a couple of weeks before that, and she had wanted on the record that her previous judge had helped her get Medicaid, I guess, for methadone, which she had struggled to get for many years, it seemed like, and she wanted that on the record, and then I guess she was, really just grateful, and she was like, obviously some people have actually go the extra mile and actually try to help the people that are there.
On Saturday night, next day, there was a child that was brought down from the placement he was in when he wasn't supposed to be, so it wasn't even to be there. The judge still had brought into the courtroom and talked with him and made him feel like he was part of the process and let him know what was going on in the case, so when he was still going to be in court again, so he was aware of what was going on, so he didn't feel like he was just left out of the system. And I thought that was very, very good.
Yeah. The first judge, I sat in on two judges, and the first one I sat in on, as soon as the litigants came up in front of him, he was, making a couple jokes, making it very loose, making it, you could tell, if you're, two people getting divorced, you're obviously, as I said, very stressed out, but he made the environment a lot more loose and a lot more relaxed for them. And I thought that was something I admired, because I think it eased the people into what is, very troubled process.
Anybody else hear anything you admired?
Yeah.
What?
Well, along the same lines, the judge was very, very sympathetic. There was a couple that came in there, they'd been married, I think, for 14 years, and they were doing it like a divorce. But there was also talk that he might have been about. So the judge spent literally 20 minutes telling them how he was in love, and he was he recommended me go to coffee, actually. He was just very sympathetic, not even to them, but in general. He was trying to keep things on tape, and he was very sympathetic to all of
us.
I think that the one thing that I was a sexual appreciation.
Anybody else? Yeah, what do you say?
I think along the same lines as everybody else, I can suggest that I saw teaching disabilities were mainly partial, even though some of the things that came out while the husband was on the stand were outrageous. The fact that he apparently sexually abused his granddaughter, offered her money to touch her, and you know, just all these things came out, but still he was extremely fair, and he was extremely just there was no judgment, there, and he was just very, very, very capable of kind of putting those issues out the window and just administering fairness to both sides. So that was pretty admirable that he didn't look down on anything that was too hard, even though that's his job. But still, I mean, he was just admirable.
Judging but not judgmental.
Anybody else? See anything they admire? Any behavior by any lawyers they admire?
Why don't we let Tina, we got about 5 minutes, let Tina wrap up with the panel, whatever.
Well, actually, I just had a few, but we...
about one of Anita's points about parents not being allowed in. I don't think it was rude or anything. I don't know what the rules are in New York, but juvenile delinquency proceedings are private and they're confidential, so that's why the parents and other kids can't be in the courtroom at the same time. So I don't know if that's what it was. Maybe on a positive note that it wasn't supposed to be negative that they weren't in the courtroom. I don't know if it was the rules.
Yeah, but I mean, not other cases, but I feel like even with... I think there was a couple of times where the lawyers would be in the room and they were kind of just waiting around for the proceeding to start. And I think one of the parents tried to come in and they kind of just, kicked her out. And I don't know, I just feel like the way they were interacting with them, and, you know, they were in a separate room and they come in for, 30 seconds, you, quickly go through it and they're out again.
Sounds like you're talking about the way it was handled. You're talking about a rule of law that says we want to protect the juvenile's privacy, therefore...
Sorry.
Well, you explained it very clearly. I bet that what she's saying is that explanation, that clarity of your explanation was not right.
And I don't think the lawyers would necessarily wait with the clients, because a lot of times they talk to the judge before the clients come in about the matter, or they have other clients that are going to be coming into the court, so they don't want to be with one client rather than the other when they're both waiting out there.
Right.
Well, there's a lot of different things. I think what's new to that is the parents and the... children at the juvenile detention aren't allowed in until they're brought in, but the parents, at least in the proceedings in Adams County, are always allowed in. And they just can't come in until they're told to come in. So if you try to come in before, you're going to get yelled at, and you might not understand why they're yelling at you. The lawyers usually come in first, and they'll talk to the judge, and then the parents and the child are always brought in separately. So then that's just, I don't know if it's procedural, then it's important or not.
That segues into the final thing. What would you change if you could change it?
A lot.
Start with one thing.
Pick one.
Pick one.
I guess for me, the bottom line problem mainly is the way our attitude towards the cases and towards court and litigation in general. I feel like I said before, it seems like everything's just becoming procedure and very routine, and that everyone's just doing what they think they need to do to just get the case over with. And there's no specific tension paid to, every specific case. It's just kind of come on, let's go, next case, not paying attention. And that's why the clients feel, detached from their cases. That's why they don't want lawyers, and that's why the courts don't care, because no one else cares. And I feel like that's the point we're at right now. And I feel like if we gave family court more attention, and I feel like family court is probably the most important part of our entire court system because that's the family. And, you know, all our opinions of the judges, you know, say all this, like, flowery language about how much, you know, family is so important and how it's, you know, the cornerstone of our society, but look at your court system. I mean, it's so messed up. And, like, even the difference between the different, like, the boroughs and, you know, Napa County, like, I feel like it's ridiculous, especially if Napa County is, like, the richest. And I feel like it's because there's a lack of care and there's a lack of respect and there's a lack of concern and ability to deal with human beings. I think that's our problem.
I actually found it quite entertaining. I guess that's not so good. But one of the main thing that I noticed is that I think there's a direct correlation between the amount of time they spent in court and the level of animosity and the tension that was created. Like in the first case, there's a preliminary conference where that was the first time in court, and they were very cordial to each other, the husband and the wife. The next case was the spouse's support, and they had obviously been there a few times, and there was a lot of yelling back and forth. And the last case was by the child support hearing, they were just killing each other. The court officer had to come up at one point and physically push the husband back into his seat. The husband was crying. It was total chaos. And I think it was obvious that it was proportionate to the amount of time they spent in court. You know, it just the tension just compounds. You know, on each time that they go. And I think that the way that, you know, I mean, Professor Zabi spoke about it is to nip it in the bud originally, and maybe, you know, go through some type of other method like mediation or arbitration where it won't allow the amount of court, you know, time to build up, and the you know, the tension won't be fulfilled either.
I guess, I mean, in terms of changes to the court, I mean, I think when we talked about in class in terms of unifying court systems, I think once you get there, the idea is to make it easy as possible for them. But I think what I focus on and changes that I would suggest would be, you know, way before they ever get to that point, I think education is the key. I think what we focus on, we should focus on, yeah, you know, trying to teach young people to make better decisions, trying to teach parents parenting skills, trying to give people the skills that they need to stay away from these types of situations. I mean, divorce is another thing. I mean, I guess it has to do with the kind of court that I saw. But I think what I came away with is that, you know, sort of family law and reality or sort of and regular law are fairly incompatible. And so, I mean, I think it's true, though. So I think that more the focus has to be on beforehand and education and keeping people away from these situations.
Mine is pretty simple. Make it more like Queens. I don't know that the Queens system is perfect, but it was, you know, they took it seriously. Especially in the IGB cases, there is a criminal matter involved. Domestic violence is a crime. So I don't think it should have, even if you're trying to promote maybe a more familiar atmosphere with family law stuff in general, this is not just family law, this is also criminal. There's been violence in the family. So I think it should be taken more seriously, and it should be conducted more like an actual courtroom should be conducted. And the other thing too is in Queens, I don't know about in terms of in general and national, in Queens I just happen to know that there is a family justice center located directly behind the criminal court that has services for families in everything. They would have attorneys there for people who couldn't afford lawyers for their matrimonial matters. They would have counseling for the domestic violence center, counseling for the children, all located directly behind the courtroom, all in one central location for these people, and they would know that it's there because there are signs all around. So I think that just the additional services and support surrounding it just shows how much that jurisdiction really cares about the issues.
Just to add on to what everybody's been saying, really keeping these families out of the court as much as possible, you know, if they're coming in for scheduling and this and that, like, is it really necessary to continually bring these people into such a stressful environment when we can possibly avoid that? That's a question, I guess, for another day, whether we can do that or not. But really keeping them out and also making them as comfortable as possible within that environment when they are there, as I saw with the first judge that I sat in on, how we made it a more stress-free environment. I think that's something we really need to do as a defendant.
And I agree with
that.
Everybody,
the only
thing I would add is cultural
awareness.
Thank you, and thanks very much to Tina for organizing.
Thank you.
All right. Let's make some kids funny ways on Thursday. Anybody wants that brochure for Friday? I'm putting it
come Friday.
All day.
Pretty.
What was interesting was we were basically trying to figure out the federal court that we wanted. We were trying to figure out, last year we just made a good court and not very successful. They just turned in something. This year we had something.
And it was tough.
Well, all right, I'll walk you over here.
See you.
Thank you.